Broward County's two healthcare systems get one leader. The defunded arts in Miami get a lifeline, and the Florida Keys get an emergency operations center. Finally. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss a major leadership merger of Broward County's taxpayer-funded North and South health systems. Can Shane Strum pull off this double duty? We'll also look at how arts institutions in Miami-Dade County are finding ways to overcome Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's veto of state funding. Because, well, the show must go on. And we'll ask why it took hurricane-prone Monroe County so long to get a hurricane emergency center. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. And a reminder, you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. When it comes to Broward County controversies of late, most of the oxygen in the room has usually been taken up by the perennially dysfunctional public schools district or sheriff's office. But under the radar, there's been administrative troubles at another just as important Broward institution, Memorial Healthcare System, otherwise known as the South Broward Hospital District. This month, Memorial's board severed the contract of CEO Scott Wester because it said he, quote, didn't have a vision for the future. But rather than find a new Memorial CEO, the board this week simply made the CEO of Broward's other taxpayer-funded health system, Broward Health, also known as the North Broward Hospital District, the boss of both systems. That man is Shane Strum, who is now responsible for running not one, but two of the largest healthcare systems in the country, including high-profile sites like the Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital. The big question, of course, is whether that double duty is best for Broward's patients. Joining me now in the studio to consider that concern is WLRN's Broward County reporter, Carlton Gillespie. Carlton, how are you?
Good, Tim.
Let's first give folks an appreciation of why this matters. I mentioned Broward's public schools earlier, the sixth largest district in the country. Likewise, Broward's two health systems are among the country's largest too, right? So what sort of size are we talking about here? How many hospitals? How many patients? What sort of budgets?
We're talking about at least combined, you know, more than 12 hospitals and other sites that are considered thousands and thousands of bed. And realistically, they serve all of Broward County as a public health option. Together, if you combine them, they're one of the largest public hospital systems in the country behind, you know, like the VA.
I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of potential patients served.
That's right. We're talking thousands of employees. We're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands in capital projects. I mean, it's a substantial amount of money.
And describe how these two systems as taxpayer-funded entities operate. It's something similar to the Jackson Health System here in Miami-Dade County, right?
Yeah, so they set their own tax rates. So each of them will set a millage rate for each budget year to get the funds that they need to fund their systems. But they have to treat everybody that comes in regardless of insurance.
Right. Like Jackson here in Miami-Dade.
Exactly. Right. But like Jackson, that doesn't mean that they only treat people without insurance. They have to try and kind of diversify their offerings to attract folks, you know, with insurance to get that kind of revenue, because they both do seek to get revenue at the end of the day.
Right. What are the differences, if any, between the two Broward systems? I mean, you know, like as I said, here in Miami-Dade, we're used to just sort of one system like this, meaning Jackson. But these are two distinct Broward healthcare systems. Does that mean that they're sort of different in how they offer services, for example?
Well, not really. Well, so the difference, I guess, geographically, right, is basically Griffin Road, right in the middle of Broward County.
Right.
Everything north of Griffin is Broward. Everything south is
Memorial. Yeah.
But one of the things that's really interesting, they both have a children's hospital. Obviously, you mentioned Joe DiMaggio and Salus Children's Hospital in the Broward district. But that also means that for doctors in Broward County, you have two separate public systems that are competing for you,
mm-hmm.
you know, competing for state funds, for federal funds, competing for labor, competing right. for things like that. It creates a very interesting competition dynamic.
Right. And they both belong to two very distinct tax districts.
That's right.
So it's not like there's any sort of meshing of the two systems at all, really. It's like you said, competing.
Right. They're insulated and they're competitors.
Has it always been that way in Broward?
Well, so these are very old. I think they both go back at least into almost till the 40s. So for a long time, these kinds have been set up and these kind of walls have stayed up since then.
Wow. Very different. Yeah. So we have this bifurcated healthcare system in Broward, North and South districts. What, if anything, then has been going wrong in the South system, known as Memorial, that prompted its board to get rid of its CEO, Scott Wester? Their, quote, lack of vision complaint would seem to suggest there are problems at Memorial that require better vision than Wester's if they're going to be fixed. Do we know what problems might be nagging the system?
Well, I mean, there are some, right? The age of some of the hospitals, their flagship hospital is I think almost 70 years old.
Okay.
You know, these things need money. You know, wait times have always been a problem at Broward
Hospitals. So updating infrastructure is a big concern.
Big
then.
Time.
And that does require vision, yeah.
Right. Well, okay. And the thing is, it's hard. I mean, you know, every 3 years they have to do a community health care update where they kind of prioritize their their vision moving forward. They have mm-hmm. to do that through the ACA, and they've got things like access to care, community education, health and wellness, and mm-hmm. you know, social needs like health literacy and stuff like that.
And are these two systems, are they involved in research at all? Or is that not their purview as sort of public taxpayer funded systems?
Well, I think when you look up at the North, Sturm has kind of because of these two different management styles that each of the CEOs had, I think we'll uh-huh. expand on that. But Sturm has gone to FAU and some of these research
okay.
laboratories and gotten uh-huh. some of that component in there.
Good point. Yes, let's get to that a little later then. So, of course, a big question then is, if Memorial or the South Broward Hospital District has these vision concerns, why not find someone to replace Wester with a better vision rather than simply make the CEO of Broward Health, Mr. Strum, the North Broward Hospital District, the overlord of both these massive systems?
Well, this might be less of a Wester prop, like a anti-Wester, than it is a pro-Sturm. Because if you think about what Broward Health looked like before he took over, mm-hmm. you know, in 2019, they had to settle a $70 million fraud case. You know, this is a system that's been in a lot of trouble. And Sturm has come in and got a ton of funding through some of his connections. He was a former chief of staff.
That's interesting that it was the North system, actually, that really had the bigger controversy going for it.
It had the bigger controversy and has kind of made the faster turnaround. I mean, you know, uh-huh. there's discussions that
Under Strum.
So right. it may be maybe like a jealousy thing right. where they've thought, well, he's doing so well up there. We're yeah. getting left behind because, you know, Wester is a career kind of healthcare services guy, an institutional guy who understood how things run. And Strum right. was a outsider, more of that kind of headhunted CEO sort of mm-hmm. a thing that has come in and gotten things done really effectively.
Yeah, in a second, I want to get into the sort of more political background he has that perhaps has served him better in that sense. My understanding is that the boards of both Broward Health and Memorial don't actually want to merge the two systems, or perhaps can't, because as we just mentioned, they represent two distinct tax districts. But if you're putting one guy in charge of both of them, isn't that pretty much the same thing?
Right. I think it's maybe more of we have to speculate because we don't know a lot of the details here, but yeah. we'd have to assume it's more of a can't than a don't want to, right? Because
right, okay.
they have teamed up together. They have a new facility out in Sunrise that they had their first ever joint meeting
right.
2 years ago to come together to build. So there has been signs that those walls are maybe a little more permeable.
Right. And I do want to emphasize both boards of the North and South systems had to sign off on this new leadership arrangement
right.
together.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, and I'm glad you mentioned those joint ventures, too. Those are interesting. But then, so why does the Memorial Board have so much confidence in the Broward Health Director, Shane Strum? What are the important things to know about him? He's apparently well-connected with Florida state government, right? And more important, Governor DeSantis.
Right, a former chief of staff there. And I think that's really been the biggest feather in his cap is his ability to get, we mentioned earlier, some of those state and federal funds, you know, the kind of more of the networking and connection things you can do as the head of this system to get things like FAU on board and some of these different programs instilled. And that's what's made him so successful in the North. Now, this is an unprecedented amount of extra work on his plate,
to say the least.
So it would be impossible to say that the level of performance can stay the same.
Right. And it appears that Strum is not doing this for the money. I mean, he makes $1.3 million as CEO of Broward Health. Wester made $1.47 million as CEO of Memorial. And yet Strum isn't really taking any additional compensation for the double duty of running both Broward Health and Memorial. What's the reality here?
Well, right. There is a nominal salary of either $1 to $26.
That's right.
We've heard,
he's essentially said, I'll be your dollar a year man.
Right, yeah. which wouldn't get me to stay in the office an extra hour, let alone take over, you know, an additional double of the duty.
Exactly.
But I think part of it and why this is important is that, you know, Wester's contract had another year on it.
Right.
So he still has to get paid that nearly $1.5 million this upcoming year.
Yeah.
So maybe it was Strum decided that was maybe a bad look to say, well, you've got to get, you know, we'd have to, because it is taxpayer money.
Right, and taxpayers' example aren't going to really like forking over the equivalent of three CEO salaries in this case, right?
Yeah. Right.
Okay. But however, would that change after next year is over and Strum is still in charge of the, do we anticipate him then taking extra compensation once that sort of those optics look better?
You'd have to think.
Yeah.
I mean, if he's going to have to basically almost double his workload, you'd have to think that there is some compensation. Is it going to be, you know, $1.47 million? Is it going to be Wester's salary? Maybe. Could it be something in the middle? Who knows?
But do we have a sense as to how temporary or permanent this will be? Is Strum just holding the fort for Memorial to give the board time to find a replacement for Wester? I think is a big question, too, right?
So Strum's title is interim.
Okay.
Right? It is interim.
Good to know. Good to know.
However, they are not, Memorial's board has said, they are not looking for a replacement at this time just yet.
Okay.
So take both of those kind of conflicting ideas as you will. He is an interim. He's interim, but also they're not looking.
It reminds me of, you know, of everything we went through the Broward County Public Schools trying to find a new superintendent. I mean, it's like deja vu up there.
Well, I don't think there will be six new CEOs in the next 2 years.
Okay, good. Apart from compensation, then, let's go back to the vision thing. What vision do you think the Memorial Board hopes Strum will bring to the South Broward Hospital District that Wester didn't? What has Strum done at Broward Health that they hope he'll carry into Memorial?
Well, I think we've talked about it. It's making those research connections. It's getting those funding for projects. There's a lot of, we mentioned infrastructure investment. That kind of stuff gets a lot easier when the state and the federal government are paying for it. And Strum has the kind of connections to make those things happen in a way that Wester maybe didn't.
Yeah, good point. But what should people's concerns here be? Is it realistic to think that one CEO can really handle the demands of running both of these very large Broward healthcare systems? Have we heard any skeptical voices out there about this yet?
Well, I think one of the things you have to think about is we talked about it. These are competing interests. Yeah. He's now the CEO of both. You know, there may be some conflicts of those interests. If Memorial and Broward are still these separate insulated tax districts that compete for labor, compete for funds, you know, he's going to have to be very careful to make sure that he's not showing any favoritism to one or the other, right?
Yeah, no, very, very good point. Carlton, in the 30 seconds we have left here, how are things going in the rest of Broward County?
Oh, in 30 seconds, I thought if we had another segment, maybe. Well, you know, things are okay. I think the sheriff's office budget was big, and the International Police Unions Agency just sent a letter to DeSantis saying that even though they got $70 million additional dollars, they're putting pressure to not have this kind of fight again. So it'll be interesting to see sheriff's funding moving forward. Still going to be a thing in Broward.
So things a little more tranquil on that front. Good. Carlton Gillespie is WLRN's Broward County reporter. Carlton, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, how the arts in Miami are surviving without Florida's money. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Just a reminder, you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or on WLRN.org. Florida's arts and culture scene was jolted hard this summer when Republican Governor Ron DeSantis vetoed state funding. That meant $32 million cut from the budgets of theater programs, museums, and hundreds of other arts nonprofits from Pensacola to Key West. The arch-conservative DeSantis blamed what he saw as, quote, sexual content in state-funded arts enterprises for his decision. DeSantis' critics dispute his argument and insist he was just, per usual, trying to own the libs. Either way, DeSantis' veto has left arts-rich pockets of Florida like Miami-Dade County scrambling to find ways to make up for the lost funds or find ways to put on the show with a lot less. Miami Beach this month came through with a $500,000 lifeline to its arts and culture organizations, such as Miami City Ballet and the Holocaust Museum, or Memorial, excuse me. But elsewhere, with the county having to cut $1 million from its arts budget, those groups are having to get extra innovative as the arts season begins. Joining me now in the studio to tell us how the arts here are overcoming is Amanda Rosa. She's the arts reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Amanda, thanks for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to first take a step back and revisit for folks how this really sharp cut of state funding for the arts came about. What was it that triggered Governor DeSantis's conservative ire and led him to decide, you know what, we're just not going to give out any state grants for arts and culture this year?
Yeah, that's the $32 million question. So this all boils down to the fringe festivals, which are these alternative theater festivals that happen in places like Tampa and Orlando. I personally have never been to one, but from what I saw, they have different types of theatrical or comedic performances. Some are family friendly. Others are meant specifically for adults. You know, maybe you'll have a burlesque show. Maybe there'll be a drag show. DeSantis has characterized these festivals as inherently sexual, though the people who organize those festivals say they are not sexual.
And it was the one in Orlando that particularly sort of got him triggered, right?
Right. Exactly. I think so.
So that he sort of then decided that, well, we've got to withhold funding for arts in general because we've got to reconsider how this money is being distributed to the arts in the state, right?
Right.
That was his rationale. So how hard was Miami-Dade County hit by this $32 million arts funding veto? Your article this week points out, for example, several instances of layoffs at arts organizations, as well as cutbacks on performances and exhibitions. What's been the biggest impact?
Honestly, the biggest impact is, frankly, people's jobs. A lot of arts organizations that I've spoken to, they've told me that when they learned about these art cuts, their immediate reaction was to figure out how to save people's jobs and salaries. A lot of these arts organizations told me that when they get grants from the state or county or any other way that they get grants, they reinvest that money, back into the community by hiring local artists, local workers. So ultimately, you know, the biggest impact is on everyday Miamians who need these job opportunities in the arts industry.
So it's livelihoods as well as performances and paintings and things of that nature. Amanda, what are some of the examples of arts and cultural organizations facing budget shortfalls that really stood out for you in your reporting?
There are many. I mean, I think a lot about City Theater, which is a Brickell-based theater organization, a nonprofit. They do a lot of different types of programming besides putting on plays, and a lot of what they have is free programming that's meant for kids or seniors. They've had to cut 25% of that programming, which, you know, it's one of those things where if it's something that you enjoy going to or seeing, it's one of those things where you don't miss it until it's gone. You don't notice that it's gone until suddenly those things that you were relying to take your kids to or your grandparents to, it just doesn't exist anymore.
Was there a consideration, for example, to start charging for some of these traditionally free events and presentations?
You know, maybe, but the thing is that for a lot of these organizations, they really had to come up, they had to reconfigure everything on the fly. For a lot of organizations, their budget was already done for the next season. They thought they had everything squared away and ready to go.
Yeah, because we should emphasize this veto was entirely unexpected.
It was
across the state.
A lot of arts organizations said that they were completely blindsided by this, and they had to make, in some cases, especially the smaller organizations, they had to make some hard cuts. When I think of City Theater, you know, they had a part-time employee that helped them a lot, and they were training that person to become full-time. They had to cut that position entirely.
They're
down a person, and they're trying to figure out ways to make sure that they can still, you know, hire the artists who they typically hire and still provide some pre-programming to the community.
Some of these organizations would seem to be cultural institutions that even a conservative governor like DeSantis would want to see funded, though. Like, as I mentioned, Miami Beach's Holocaust Memorial. Mm-hmm. Has there been any backlash from even fellow Republicans to his rather blanket veto?
You know, if there was backlash, it's not particularly loud. Haven't really seen that much reaction generally from Republicans. The biggest reaction, besides the arts community, have been from Florida Democrats, who, of course, tend to disagree with DeSantis in general. A notable person who came out and said that he really disagreed with the governor is George Perez, who's a very well-known art collector. He's the namesake of the Perez Art Museum in Miami.
Right. Here, yeah.
Right. And a real estate mogul. And he said that this decision by DeSantis was a really bad move, both socially, but also economically.
But how are these arts organizations then overcoming the big budget cuts? What sort of creative, out-of-the-box thinking have you found them exercising in order to make the curtains rise and the exhibit doors open again?
Yeah. Well, arts organizations and artists in general are very resilient people. They're used to having to get creative on the fly.
Yeah.
You know, one example that brings a smile to my face is at Zoetic Stage, which is another theater nonprofit. They're going to put on...
And where are they located?
They perform at the Adrian Art Center, but I believe.
Okay.
I believe. But they're going to do Fiddler on the Roof, which is usually done with like a cast of 30 people.
Yeah.
They typically do small performances, but they had to pare it down even further. So they have a cast of 10 folks, and some minor characters will be played by puppets, which, you know, that's fun. But also, they've had to get that creative by allocating money that, you know, maybe this year we can't do this show. Maybe this year we'll do less of this free programming. Mm-hmm. So they had to, in many cases, a lot of arts organizations have shrunk what they offer to the community, but while still trying to keep a high quality of what they offer.
Resourcefulness has become quite the prize commodity then in this situation. But there have been signs of arts funding lifelines emerging in the wake of DeSantis's veto. This month, as I mentioned, the Miami Beach City Commission did come up with $500,000 to keep about 16 arts and culture nonprofits running, right? And Miami-Dade County was able to contain the cut to its art funding budget from what was looking like $2.5 million to less than $1 million, right? How did all this come about?
Yeah, in Miami Beach in particular, even before there was discussion in the Miami-Dade County proposed budget of less funding going towards arts grants compared to last year, you know, after DeSantis's veto, the city of Miami Beach commissioners decided to be proactive and put forth a plan to help fund 16 Miami Beach arts organizations. You know, the roughly $500,000, that's not going to completely fill the gap of what these groups are missing. Like, what they would have gotten would have been a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as Howard Herring, who works at New World Symphony, said, it lessens the sting of the governor's cut.
Can we expect to see other sorts of lifelines on the horizon from perhaps more private sources, for example, or special fundraising performances and events and things like that? Will we see more of that?
I think so. I feel like that's going to be something that we're going to see in the future. I mean, even recently, you know, to mention George Perez again, at a county meeting, Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava mentioned that he pledged, I believe, $300,000 to go towards Miami-Dade arts organizations. And we'll see. Like I said, arts organizations in general tend to get very creative. Off the top of my head, I know Gable Stage, their board of directors is planning or is doing a match campaign to get more fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, arts organizations are definitely reaching out to donors in the community. But time and time again, what they've said is that they want people to know the best way to support them is to just go to the theater, go get a ticket.
And in the 30 seconds we have left, Amanda, are the arts leaders in this community expecting this to be just a one-off thing, or are they expecting DeSantis to do this sort of veto again next year?
It depends on who you ask. Some people say this is just a one-time thing, but other folks have completely lost their trust in the governor and the state government.
Amanda Rosa is arts reporter for the Miami Herald. Amanda, great reporting and many thanks.
Thank you.
And while we're talking about the arts here, I just want to let our listeners know about WLRN's new arts and culture newsletter, the AC. It's a curation of stories and deep dives that celebrate South Florida's rich arts community. Visit WLRN.org to subscribe. Still to come, the Keys get an emergency operations center. Better late than never. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Just a reminder, you can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or on WLRN.org. We want to pause a moment and direct our thoughts to our fellow Floridians on the Gulf Coast who were battered last night by Hurricane Helene. Scenes this morning showed us the Category 4 storm brought devastating wind damage and record-breaking storm surge. A million people are without power. So far, officials have confirmed 7 deaths. It's hard to imagine a slice of Florida that's more vulnerable to hurricanes than the Keys. The archipelago, after all, has been the site of some of the state's worst storms, like the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, which is still considered the strongest on record to ever hit the U.S. So you'd think that if there was one place that had a long-standing Emergency Operations Center, or EOC, it would be Monroe County. Think again. The Florida Keys just cut the ribbon on its first ever EOC this week. In fact, Monroe County was the only Florida county left that didn't have an EOC. So finally, whenever a major storm strikes the Keys, emergency and public safety staff can now stay in place and do their jobs instead of having to evacuate like everybody else. The new EOC building is smartly situated 20 feet above sea level. I didn't even think there was a place in the Keys 20 feet above sea level, and can withstand 220-mile-an-hour winds. Joining me now to tell us how this finally came about and why it took so long is WLRN's Keys reporter, Julia Cooper. Julia, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me back.
As always. So I want to start with the fact that just a few days after Monroe County's new Emergency Operations Center opened this week, Julia, the Lower Keys did have to deal with the effects of Hurricane Helene as it passed through Cuba and the Yucatan. What did the Keys feel, and did the new EOC get used at all as a result?
Absolutely. And yes, it did. So we saw winds reach up to 67 miles per hour. That was one gust that was recorded in the Lower Keys. Like a lot of other parts of South Florida, at one point we were under a tropical storm warning. And so the things that we were worried about were flooding and winds. But, you know, I checked in yesterday with local officials down in Key West, and they were concerned for things like their marinas. But so far, as for structural damage, no one is reporting any real big structural damage, which was great. We were largely spared. Mm-hmm. The only thing that we're worried about now is, again, floodwaters. The Upper Keys, in fact, are still under a coastal flood warning that'll last until tomorrow morning. And so what we're dealing with is just what the National Weather Service says is slowly receding floodwaters.
But at least, and for this storm, there was an EOC there this time. The big question, of course, though, is why was Monroe County, of all places, the most hurricane-vulnerable corner of the most hurricane-vulnerable state in the country, the last county in Florida to have an emergency operations center?
So what local officials, several local officials were saying was it was a matter of funding. This project finally came together through a number of different state and federal funding sources. Actually, our county mayor told me that the only money that the county is putting in is for operational costs. And so the money that was put into the construction of the building came primarily from outside sources.
And the amount of money it took then to build this was what, more or less?
I don't have that figure on
Okay.
hand.
How in the world, though, did the Keys get along for the past century without an emergency operations center? How did emergency officials and first responders deal with events like hurricanes in years past?
So before the building, emergency managers would actually turn the Board of County Commission chambers into a makeshift EOC. But buildings in the Keys aren't rated to safely withstand strong hurricanes. So during times of anything that is a Category 3 or higher hurricane, emergency managers would have to evacuate along with the rest of the general public.
Right. So tell us about the new facility, starting with where exactly it's located.
Yeah, so it is in Marathon, which is smack dab in the middle of the Florida
Right.
Keys, on the southern end of the Marathon Airport there. It's actually the site where, during Hurricane Irma, vital supplies were flown in to help support recovery efforts. I can talk a little bit more about the building specs itself. It's over 28,000 square feet, again, built over 20 feet above sea level, and that's because it is on these large pilings or stilts.
Ah, okay. So
And
it's not a it's not really a natural, naturally 20 feet above sea level. It's sort of man-made in that sense then.
correct,
Oh, okay.
yes.
All right.
And with generators and their wastewater storage, they are able to withstand up to 150 people for about 96 hours or 4 days in the case of power going out.
All right. So how do Monroe County officials see the new EOC helping people in the Keys respond to and recover from events like hurricanes better than before?
I mean, just the sheer fact that everyone coordinating preparedness messaging and then after recovery efforts, they'll all be in one building now. And so that's going to do wonders for the level of communication that's necessary for them
Right.
during a hurricane. The building is also going to permanently house Fire Rescue Administration and the Sheriff's Office 911 dispatchers. And so the dispatchers actually have expanded capabilities now. They were in a building where they only had five stations for dispatchers, now they'll have nine. So there's going to be likely more probability for public safety benefits year round, not just during hurricane season too.
Now, the hurricane season, of course, still has 2 months to go, but so far the Keys have not experienced a significant storm, with perhaps the exception of Hurricane Debby last month. Do Monroe County officials feel pretty fortunate this year so far?
Yes, I think across the board, people are really grateful that we've largely been spared so far. But of course, we are always diligently watching forecasting during this time.
And finally, Julia, how do you feel about the new Keys EOC as a journalist? I mean, as WLRN's Keys reporter, you're probably going to have to hunker down there overnight when a big hurricane does hit the area. Does it look comfortable?
It does look comfortable, and there is a wonderful press room with a window that actually overlooks the EOC's command center.
Aha.
But I did ask officials if there was going to be opportunities for press to say in the EOC during hurricanes. It doesn't look like at this moment that is in their official plans.
Okay.
But who knows? That could change in the future.
Julia Cooper is WLRN's Keys reporter. Julia, many thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
Finally, on the roundup, here's a new train of thought. Why fly to Chicago from Miami in 3 hours when you can get there by rail in 40 hours? That's actually not a sarcastic question. Those 40 hours would be a pretty memorable scenic journey through the country. That's at least the sales pitch at Amtrak, which this week announced a new temporary route connecting the Magic City to the Windy City. The Floridian, as the line will be called, will offer round-trip service that sojourns from Lake Michigan down through Washington, D.C., and into the Sunshine State, with stops including Jacksonville, Orlando, and Tampa. Again, it's probably not the business traveler's preference, but speaking as a dad who used to drive the family minivan on two-day holiday trips from Miami to Indiana, I can say I would have preferred to spend that time on a train engaged with my kids instead of an interstate. Just a thought. The Floridian is set to make its first trip November 10th. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.